Segelreporter Vendée-Globe Spezial. Der Podcast mit Carsten Kämling, Miku und Stefan Boden. Präsentiert von Boat24, der Bootsbörse mit über 29.000 Angeboten. www.boat24.com. Der 25.01.2025 und heute ist eine ganz besondere Folge. Boris Herrmanns Team hat uns mehrfach ja nicht geantwortet auf unsere Anfragen zu einem Podcast. Ganz schnell ging die Antwort von Conrad Coleman. Der hat mir nach ein paar Minuten, glaube ich, geantwortet, dass er dabei ist. Und jetzt ist es soweit, er befindet sich auf dem Atlantik. Carsten wartet schon in der anderen Leitung. Ich switch jetzt um auf Englisch und dann switche ich danach um auf die andere Aufnahmetechnik. Nicht ganz trivial, wird aber funktionieren, hab's getestet. Und ich hoffe, ihr habt viel Spaß mit dem Crazy Kiwi Conrad Coleman. So we are now connected to Conrad Coleman, who is in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean in the Northern Hemisphere. Hi Conrad, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here and have the opportunity to join you from, as you say, the middle of the sea. This is quite original, and it's thanks to the great new satellite connections that we have at the moment. When I was growing up in New Zealand, we would hear on the radio very occasionally the sort of crackly disconnected voice from sailors at sea, and so it's great to now have the opportunity to be that voice from sea, but to have it in a more in a clearer, more high fidelity way.
Yeah, sure. I guess your internet connection is better than ours here in Germany. The other voice maybe. Is that you hear is Carsten Kämling, the editor-in-chief, called nickname is the Podcasten. But let me start with the question to get warm. Tell us about your situation right now. Where are you and what do you expect the next days?
Yeah, it's a little surprising because as I'm talking to you now, I'm standing up and I'm holding onto the boat with two hands because we have 34, 35 knots of wind. And the forecast was for 25. And so it's been gusting 45 during the night. I have at the moment two reefs in the main and the J3, the small jib. And I'm currently doing sort of 15 to 22 knots of boat speed. It depends on the surfs or the way that I manage to line things up on the waves. But the waves are very tricky at the moment. It's very, very short, very, very steep waves. And because we're sort of on a close reach, doing 15 to 20 knots of boat speed, it's incredibly uncomfortable and actually quite dangerous on board the boat, because the boat is fast, but then also upwind. So we're slamming up, over, and sometimes through the waves. So it's a little bit sporty at the moment.
So harder than you expected. But when I look at the ranking, you are on 21st position. That means on third position of the non-foilers, right?
Yes, that's right. That's right. I've got John Lecam 85 miles behind me, and coming sort of into the equatorial zone. He had a problem with his J2 sail, and then also got stuck in the calms, and he ended up a long, 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 long way east. And so as we now started to get into the new wind and start going north, he's been sailing quite low. And back out towards the west. And strategically, I wanted to sail a tighter angle and keep heading towards the north. So he converted his easterly position into speed out to the west, and I've stayed north. So now, strategically, I've got him due south of me and 85 miles behind. And so I'm kind of in a controlling position there. So that option has worked out very well for me for the last 3 days. And then ahead of me, I have Benjamin Ferré, who's on the boat called Monoyeur, and also Tanguy Le Turquet on the pink boat Lazare. And so they are first, second, I'm third, and at the moment I'm trying to keep Jean Lecam in fourth. But He's a bit of a legend of ocean racing, and it's not going to be easy to keep him there.
When I prepared myself for this podcast, I read a lot about you. I mean, not that I read first time about you, because I follow you since 2016, and I can say I'm one of your biggest fans here in Germany, and my wife is the second biggest.
Yes, it's right.
Thank you.
That's true. That's really true.
Carsten knows it. We talk a lot in this in our Vendée Globe special podcast that we do like since November, since the start, every 2 or 3 days. The funny thing is, it's really a fun fact. To your bold MS Emlyn is from 2007, and to show how old this is, do you know what in the same year what happened in 2007? Steve Jobs launched the iPhone. So we can say you're competing
That's funny.
with the iPhone 1. It's a refurbished iPhone 1 against all these iPhone Max Pro 16 and so on. So you're really good in the race, right?
I love that. That is such a great comparison. Thank you very much for making that connection. And yes, you're right. And I certainly feel the difference between my boat and the newer ones. Zhongyi on Lazar has a boat from the same generation, so has an older iPhone. Bergamo has a boat that is 4 years newer, so already is on the iPhone 4. And then you're right.
And John.
John Le Cam has a boat that was launched last year, and the boat is light and powerful. And if we're in the same conditions, then he will certainly be faster. So that's the challenge, is to try and keep a bit of a difference with him and see if I can maintain the gap. But you're right, processor speed and bandwidth is very different. And the naval architects have done a very good job in the preceding years, and so it's normal that a newer boat goes faster. And so if I manage to keep it on behind me, then that will be fantastic. But equally, if he sneaks through, then it's fairly understandable, because it's not quite an equal battle.
I remember this boat was a boat of was sailed by Thomas Rion as well.
That's right.
That's true, yeah.
Thomas had it in 2016, and
And I was a
sorry.
little bit I was a little bit afraid when you parted your way from the fleet and made the direction to Stewart Island. And I remember the pictures when Thomas Rouillon had this boat, which kind of folded in two pieces. And I said, "Oh, this is a boat Conrad is sailing right now." And then so you're going there as well. But then it was just I think it was kind of a flyer where you did a northern way, which looked pretty good for in the Southern Ocean. Then you made your way down to the south as well, and you.
That's right. Well, and you're right to bring up the storied history of this boat. It was initially launched as a Groupe Bell, and did 2 years with the skipper of Quipo de Pavant. And he had such bad luck that the boat never went further than Portugal in two attempts at the Vendée Globe. Once he dismasted north of Spain, and the other time he ran into a fishing boat off the coast of Portugal. And then Thomas Royan took it, and he made it to New Zealand before the boat broke in half. The boat was then fixed in New Zealand with new panels, and sailed back to France, whereupon Maxime Sorel, the skipper before me, was the first person to finish the Vendée Globe with this boat, but did have also a structural failure. And so when I got the boat, I did the first year, including the route to Rum, with the boat as it was. And then in 2003, we did an enormous refit on the boat, where we sanded all the paint off back to a black carbon box, and then laid down new layers of carbon fiber on the outside of the boat, both on the hull and on the deck, to reinforce the structure. And then also we built new beams, structural beams that we put underneath the deck on the inside. My goal is to not only finish the race, but be the first sailor to bring this boat home without any structural failure. And thus far, I've been able to sail with a lot of confidence, and to not feel like I'm walking on eggshells, but really have the confidence to sheet on and commit to some quite engaging weather scenarios. And I had confidence in the boat because I'm the one that laid the new carbon onto the boat myself with my own hands. And thus far, it's going well. You know, all of the sails are intact. The boat is intact. The electronic systems are working well. I'm very proud of now being less than 10 days from the finish and still having a boat that's looking great. So in the history of this boat, I'm proud to be the one that's bringing it home in one piece.
Yeah, great. So you had one problem with the blackout, and I wondered, because you told in one of your fantastic videos, I really would, everybody who hears this podcast must see your videos, because you, I want to talk about it later with you, always funny, but also very interesting things like how is the jibe, where I say after 20 seconds, okay, I'm out with my cruising old touring boat. But I wondered, how did you manage to repair a mainboard? I mean, when I imagine that I have to repair a mainboard, even I cannot do it. But if I would sit here on the table and tell my son, don't come in and don't come near, because I really have to concentrate, and please no movement in this room because it's really tricky. How did you do it on a boat? I mean, in the Southern Oceans, in a smashing boat.
Yeah, well, that was very difficult. It's like trying to imagine doing brain surgery on the back of a galloping horse. this is what it feels like. And so what happened, you're right to bring this up. It was one of the biggest technical challenges that I had on the boat. For the listeners that don't know, I'm in the process of sailing around the world without starting the engine once, and so running completely on energy that I make myself, either with the hydro generators or with primarily the solar panels. And so it's fantastic. You know, I've been at sea for almost 80 days and I haven't turned on the engine once. I haven't smelled diesel or exhaust, and so that's fantastic. And my goal is to show what is possible with renewable energy. And you know, for me, we are pushed by the wind. We should be charged just by the sun. So I'm in the process of showing what can be done, and with the goal of getting the rest of the fleet onto this principle for the following races. So that's the background. And unfortunately, it looked like one of the charge controllers for the solar panels had not been configured correctly. A very, very small mistake from an electrician, but very big consequence. Because when the battery achieved 100% of charge, the charge controller did not switch off, and instead it sent an overcharge into all of the circuits on board the boat. Oh. And so the boat is running 24 volts, and we ended up estimating that there was 34 volts going into the boat. Oy. So lots of delicate components got fried, and so obviously all of the fuses broke. But it seems like the fuses let enough power go through before they broke, that they damaged the circuit boards behind them. And so the circuit boards are exactly that. They're the sort of green printed circuit boards that we're used to seeing inside computers, with lots of capacitors and diodes and small soldered components. And working with the electronics specialists, we identified which diode had burned out and was stopping the whole circuit board from working. So you're sitting there on a bouncing boat doing circuit testing with the multimeter, and then you find the broken one, and then they say, okay, Conrad, this one has to go. And so you get the very, very small flush cutter pliers, and then stabilizing yourself, you have to make some very delicate cuts to remove the faulty diode, and then reassemble the circuit board, reassemble the charge controllers and the capacitors, and then give it power and hope that it worked. And I had to do that procedure on the circuit board for the keel control, and then also on the Starlink circuit board, and that's what allows us to be able to talk right now. Is that I had to do that procedure at least two times, and there's also a broken component in the backup pilot, but for the moment I'm counting on the fact that the primary pilot will get me there. But if I have a problem with the pilot, then I have a procedure to do something similar, which will bring the pilot back to life as well. So yeah, as I said, it's really, you have to imagine the galloping horse and the brain surgery, and that's exactly what it felt like.
Unbelievable for me.
This doesn't sound like a normal sailing race. Of course, we all know it's not the normal sailing race of Omni Globe, but this talk sounds more like a race between electricians or funny thing.
Well, in many ways it is.
It is, yeah.
Our boats are very complex. Yeah. And even as I when I rebuilt this boat, I wanted to make it as simple and as robust as possible. But inevitably, we have very complex electrical systems and very, very complex autopilot systems. And so, for example, the autopilot runs off a very high-tech compass that uses the same technology that is used in guided missiles, with the same degree of precision. And so instead of having a compass that's sort of floating on this disc and you have to go approximately northwest, this compass is able to give to the hundredth of the degree in all three axes in terms of roll, pitch, and yaw. And that means that even if, and this has happened, even if the GPS antenna fails, then the 3D compass is so precise that it can keep piloting the boat, so that the boat knows where it is, even without the GPS. So it's really quite remarkable. And this is the sort of precision and degree of technology that we need to make these boats go, because we go from the northern hemisphere to the southern hemisphere. That means that normal compasses don't work so well, because they end up pointing in the wrong way. And then we have very high-tech, high-frequency GPSs that allow the boat to steer with a great deal of precision. And I'm standing at the moment in the door, as I said, hanging on and watching the boat steer itself. And for the 25,000 miles that I've sailed since the start of the race, the pilot has driven all of them. So it's really quite remarkable.
Well, Connor, tell me, since I watch your videos and even this Vendée Globe, it's always the same. And when we see you in the Southern Ocean, like you said, on a galloping horse in 6 degrees or colder, how does it come that you're always in a good mood? Is it your nature, or did you had a coaching? Or it's always funny, even when you, after the start, you send a video and you said, yeah, it's a Vendée Globe, so we're really so full of happiness. Is it you, or
or is it good smoke? You're smoking some funny things, or I don't know.
Now you know, Amsterdam is a long way away from where I am at the moment. So
now you can tell it.
No. I mean, this is me. I'm quite resilient, mentally and emotionally, naturally, and also during the course of my career. I have already lived through many difficult and challenging experiences, and I have come out the other side, and more or less with a smile, and certainly with the knowledge that I can do it. And so that comes with experience. You know, this is my my fourth race around the world as a skipper, my second Vendée Globe, and I made a big career choice. I grew up in New Zealand, but I went to school in America. And I was already an entrepreneur in America, and I had, in many ways, a sort of more normal life planned ahead. And then I decided to change everything, move to France, learn French, learn sailing again, to come and do this and do the Vendée Globe. And so I have, you know, it's like in poker, you know, I'm all in on this option. I didn't leave myself a backup plan. I wanted to come and do the Vendée Globe or nothing at all. And so being totally committed to this option means that, you know, you have to be happy about it because this is what you chose to do with your life. And also, you know, since I started to be a sailor in 2007, I've done many, many, many transatlantics, but only four races around the world. And so it's, for me, it's an incredible privilege because these opportunities are rare, even in the light of a professional sailor. And so there's no point in working nights, weekends for years and years and years to come and to come and go sailing and then be grumpy about it. So, you know, it's a rare privilege, and for me, you've got to enjoy it.
What was harder, to learn sailing or to learn French? I mean, French. To learn French is impressive to me.
Okay. Both of them have their challenges. but for me, I had to learn French in order to learn sailing because it's better since I arrived. But there were really no English speakers. I am the only New Zealander that has done the Vendée Globe, the Route du Rhum, the Figaro. So really, I have this impression of being a bit of a trailblazer, you know, if I wanted to eat or if I wanted to learn from the coach, I needed to learn French. So again, that was all part of the option of being all in.
You pointed out a little bit about your former life when you passed Cape Horn. That I felt it. I don't know if many people know about that, but. That you have your biking history, don't you? That's what you said. That's the business you made. You were doing a kind of biking shop, or what was it like?
Yes, that's right. I worked in a bike shop, but then also I started my own brand of bike. And so I was competing as a cyclist at quite a high level.
Like mountain bikes, but then also or both street.
Hello.
Hello.
Years ago.
Okay. Got you back. Sorry. Yeah, that's right. I was as a cyclist, a mountain biker, and then I was also designing and building and having fabricated my own bike frames, and then ship selling those and internationally.
So you could have done the America's Cup for Team New Zealand. Yeah. On a bike as well.
That's right. I didn't know that was going to be an option at the time, but yes, you're right.
It's gone now again. I think they got rid of the bikers. So
yeah, the who knows? One,
but,
who knows?
But you know, yeah. Okay. Cool.
And so I discovered that that I was really good, both mentally and physically, at doing longer races. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up doing 24-hour solo mountain bike races where you start on noon on Saturday and finish noon on Sunday, and race all through the night without stopping. And I really enjoyed these races, and I got quite good at them. And once I realized that I could go hard for 24 hours, I started looking for challenges that go even longer. And so that's a little bit what for me opened the door for the Vendée Globe was, this is the ultimate endurance event in any sport. There is no other race that is 45,000 kilometers on this planet. So, that's a good challenge.
Carsten had an interesting chat on the boat exhibition in Düsseldorf. Tell us about it, Carsten.
Yeah. I mentioned that I met Rowan Guide. That's his name. Is it your manager?
That's right. Yep.
Yeah. And yep. You were just talking about it, and some, and then I saw his sign about from your sponsor, like Angry. And I said, in the next 2 days we have a chat with Conrad, and he said, how are you connected? I asked him. Oh, I'm his manager, and just tell him it's fun. And so he just can told the story about the start. That was really, which was really funny. I was there as well. I was on the media boat, and so of course at the leeward side of the line, at the pin end, and so we watched Boris Herrmann, which had a good start. And then there was your story of the start. When I came back in the harbor and said, "Well, where was Conrad?" And then we saw this on the tracker, and I didn't knew the story behind it. That and then afterwards, of course, people told us about it, and then he said his story. Maybe you tell your story. I just tell our listeners. You came a little late, and then suddenly you were far in front of the whole fleet. And what was it yes. like? Or what happened to you?
Yeah. Sure. And well, this is a great example of life in the Vendée Globe, and a good reason to learn to never, ever, ever give up. And so what happens is, it was very, very light winds for the start, if you recall, and I was unsure as to which sail I wanted to use for the start, the Big Janica or the Code Zero. And so I made a call with my team a little bit at the last moment, sort of 10 minutes before the start, that I wanted to make a sail change. And so for context, the guys need to be off the boat with 4 minutes before the start of the race. So we need to be solo on our boats in race configuration 4 minutes before the start goes. So we had enough time to quickly make this change. I guess in the rush, and also I have a team that's not so experienced. We made a mistake with the sheet, and it went over the side, and went around the prop, and so that stalled the engine, and then we had the cheek for the Janica around the propeller, and so I was really and truly stuck, and I still had the guys. On board the boat after the 4 minute limit, and so that meant that that I was not in configuration at the good time, and so I had to take a penalty.
Somebody had to dive to cut it away.
And exactly. So one of my guys put on the mask and the wetsuit and dived under the boat, unwrapped the sheet from the propeller, thankfully without cutting it. And then I requested whether I could start again, and they said that no, because I was not in configuration at the good time. Then I was no longer allowed to take the start with everybody else, and I had to do the late start. And so that meant the late start option opens 1 hour after the official start, and so my heart sank. I thought, oh no, you know they're going to be. All the boats are gone. I'm starting 1 hour after everybody. This is a terrible way to start the race.
Yeah.
But in fact, the wind was so, so calm at this point that nobody was moving anywhere. And so I went through the different start line. I took my time to prepare the good sail at the good time. And then started again with no wind at all. So I managed to go across the start line, and then I went backwards. and then finally the wind filled in, and it filled in from where I was. And so I was separate from the rest of the fleet, and I was the one that got the wind first. And this meant that that I was able to move in from the Code Zero to the Big Janica, doing these big maneuvers solo, surrounded by all of the... all of the well wishes and the zodiacs and so on, and then slowly but surely, I sailed myself into the lead and away from everybody else, and it was just amazing and incredible experience, and it showed that already this was an incredible emotional roller coaster,
yeah.
To be lining up from the start, have something go wrong, and then recover, and then have a little bit of good luck go your way. And this is exactly what the emotions that we live every day on the Vendée Globe. There is always something breaking at the wrong time. You have to fix it, and then that puts you in a good position for the rest of it. You have to be incredibly resilient and ready to jump on every opportunity.
Before we stop, because you said you had things to do on the boat, can you tell us something about your plans in the future? What is next?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, we can do a longer interview maybe after the finish if you have. What I invite your listeners to do is to send in questions. And so that means that we can really tailor the next podcast to the questions that your listeners have, and I can reply to their specific questions. So let's do that. But what's coming up is, as I said, about 10 days more of sailing. I get to the finish. I get to see my wife and my children again. So this is going to be a magic moment. But already I'm thinking about the next one. I've done two Vendée Globes. I want to do three. And also, because I grew up in New Zealand with the Whitbread, which is now the Ocean Race, coming into town. These sailors were my heroes. You know, just as Eric Tabale is the French sailing hero, Sir Peter Blake was mine, and the Whitbread was the race that New Zealanders dominated. And so I would like to get back to this. And so the next ocean race is in 2027. And I think that what would be beautiful is to create a campaign much like Boris Herdman has done, where you build a team, you do the team event, and then you transform that into a solo event. And so you take all of the energy, all of the experience, from the team side, and then channel that into the solo racing side. And then also there's it's quite an interesting campaign, because you start off doing teamwork, and then little by little you develop the pilots and you develop the systems, and so that you don't need the full team, and it's just one person that can do the job of four. So it's both a human story, a teamwork story, and also a technological story. So it's quite interesting. So what I would like to do, is this the ocean race in 27, and the Vendée Globe again in 28.
And what Rowan told me to ask you that we might see you in Kiel as well, that you might do the ocean race Europe with the old boat maybe, or is it just a plan? Because this would be what our listeners would be happy about.
Yes, well, I would like that very much. I am actively working towards this, and we need to plan a little bit for the season with the sponsors. But the plan is certainly to do the Ocean Race Europe, and it would be great to see you there. Absolutely.
Great.
I'm based in Kiel, so when you can tell your sponsors we come there with cameras and everything.
Yeah.
So
fantastic. Fantastic.
Yep. Conrad, we wish you all the best for the next 10 days. Fair winds, good waves, and sunny weather. And thank you so much that you join our podcast. And we'll come back to you after you arrive in the Sublunia, okay?
That's great. That's great. Fantastic. Yeah. I look forward to it. This was a great, great chat. Thank you. And I look forward to next time.
And we keep our fingers crossed that you keep John behind you, but maybe it's tough work still. Huh? A couple of miles to go, but yeah, you might do it.
So we see you on the podium.
Exactly.
On the non-foiler podium. Cheers, Conrad.
Exactly. That's the goal.
Cool.
Thank you. Thank you very much, guys. Cheers. Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Segelreporter Vendée Globe Spezial, der Podcast mit Carsten Kemling, Miku und Stefan Boden. Präsentiert von Boat24, der Bootsbörse mit über 29.000 Angeboten. www.boat24.com